Sports Talk New York with your hosts Mark Rosenman and AJ Carter. Sports Talk New York is sponsored in part by Prince Associates, Send in the Clowns, the Phoenix Tube Company, CelebrityTrips.com, the law firm of Decalator Cohen and DePrisco, Solomon Jewelers, and Relish Restaurant of Kings Park. Here are your hosts, Mark and AJ.
Joining us now is a third-round draft pick of the Cincinnati Bengals in the 1976 draft. He would go on to play for the Bengals for 14 seasons, including two Super Bowls, Super Bowl 16 in 1981 and 23 in 1988. He recorded 16 interceptions, 23 fumble recoveries, a franchise record. During his career, he amassed 62.5 sacks, which is the second most in Bengals history. In his first two seasons with the Bengals, he was appointed to an open seat on the Cincinnati City Council in 1988 and was elected for a second term in 1989. He received numerous honors, including selection to the NFL All-Rookie Team, the Brian Windsor White Award for Humanitarian Service, the NFL Walter Payton Man of the Year Award in 1986, and Sports Illustrated's Co-Sportsman of the Year 1987. Obviously, all those things tell you one thing about him. He is a very special person. It is a pleasure to welcome the pride of Dartmouth, Reggie Williams, to WLIE Sports Talk New York. Welcome, Reggie.
What a wonderful introduction. Thank you, Mark and AJ. It's a great day to celebrate America, 9-1-1.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, your story is absolutely amazing. Growing up in Flint, Michigan, you overcame a severe hearing disability and became an outstanding student-athlete at Southwestern High, where your scholastic achievement is what drew the attention of Dartmouth's football's coaching staff. The story goes, however, that you really wanted to go to the University of Michigan, but then-coach Bo Schembechler felt you were too small at 6'1", 215 to play in the Big Ten. How disappointed were you that you didn't become a Wolverine?
So that is really one of the key stories of my life. He actually told me that to my face in front of my head coach, Dar Christensen, and my head coach didn't even defend me. And it wasn't that I didn't have the size. He just didn't think I was that tough a player because of how academically oriented I was. But fortunately, Dartmouth not only admitted me, they allowed me to play some high-caliber Ivy League football and gave me a lot of confidence in myself. And at Dartmouth, I also was able to build on a lot of the childhood problems I had that forced me to attend Michigan School for the Deaf. I was able to take speech classes at Dartmouth that allowed me to communicate so much better and also build a lot of confidence that built turned over to a lot of the community service that I was able to do later in Cincinnati and later working for the Walt Disney Company.
You know, what was it about head coach Jake Kremelth and freshman team coach Jerry Burnt that allowed you to excel at the college level and give you that confidence?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's right there with Jerry Burnt, who was my freshman coach, who immediately appointed me a captain on the very first day of freshman practice. In those days, Ivy Leaguers were not allowed to play varsity football. So I had a year to really develop leadership skills that carried over. Jake Krauthammel, who later became the outstanding athletic director for Syracuse, while he was our head coach, he made sure that I was a linebacker, even though I personally wanted to be a running back after my childhood hero, Jim Brown. He really gave me the confidence on the varsity level to be not only a leader for Dartmouth, but to be one of the best players to come out of the Ivy League. And I am really thankful for Jake Krauthammel and Dartmouth. It really is a wonderful alma mater that I enjoy.
You know, they talk today about players, any sport, whether it's football or whether it's basketball, you know, the quote, student athletes who aren't students, they don't go to class. How important was it and how difficult was it for you to balance playing football and getting, you know, a pretty good education, doing very well in class?
Well, the education side of the college decision was paramount. Coming out of high school, especially when you have a head coach like Bo Schembechler saying that you're not good enough, there were no pro aspirations when I went to Dartmouth. I was trying to get the very best education. At the time, I was pursuing a medical degree, and became a psychology major there. And you learn to respect not only your teammates, but you learn to respect all of the other students at Dartmouth. And most of my biggest relationships and friendships took place outside of the football field, which is unique for a lot of college players. So there were a lot of things that seemed to happen because I was so well supported by my coaches that all of a sudden the potential I had as a pro athlete was realized, and I had a chance to play for the Cincinnati Bengals, but it certainly wasn't the reason I chose Dartmouth College. And it certainly is the reason that going back to my childhood, the biggest thing that I always tell children and the way I was able to overcome my hearing and speech impediment is because I love to read. And I encourage everyone, kids and adults even now, to read whenever you can.
Not only that, you know, you take a look at some of the things that you did at Dartmouth, and you know, you actually took courses in Tai Chi, and this is one visual that, since I read about this, I can't get it out of my head, Reggie. You also took ballet there. So, you know, what was you taking ballet at the college level like for you?
You know, one of the best things about ballet was putting yourself in an environment where that I wasn't the best person in the room. And I was, I think, only one, two males in the room. And yet there were some life skills that I learned in ballet that carried over to my professional football career, including one of the things that keeps me, my ability to walk even today, and that's my great balance and my flexibility, all of which I really improved by taking ballet at Dartmouth.
And interestingly enough, I'm sure that the professor in the ballet class would not echo Bo Schembechler's words, and you were not too small for ballet. The story goes that after completing your college career in 1976, you're flying home from the Hula Bowl in Hawaii to New York, and you're planning to stay at a friend's house and prepare for the NFL draft. At the airport in Cleveland during a layover, self-doubt started to creep in, and the story goes that you began actually to pray for a sign, asking God whether you should pursue your football dreams or not. And then something truly amazing happened. What happened after that?
I met the immortal and late great, greatest of all time, Muhammad Ali. And the reason that my insecurity was so high is all of a sudden, once again, I had the return of the ghost of Bo Schembechler in George Hill, who then was the defensive coordinator for Ohio State, and he was one of the coaches at the Hula Bowl who told me all week long that I wasn't good enough and only played me one play in that game, gave me so much self-doubt. I'm flying home. I'm trying to make a decision whether I should even continue to pursue an NFL dream, and I run into Muhammad Ali in a wing of an empty airport in Cleveland, Ohio, went up to him, praised him for being one of my heroes, and then told him what my situation is. And he gave me a pep talk and told me to pursue my dreams to play football. And I got a yin-yang tattoo on my forearm the very next day to commemorate that, to really say you get out of something what you put into it. And I was going to put that same energy into pursuing a pro football career as Muhammad Ali was demonstrating in his boxing career.
Truly amazing. In Cincinnati, you played under head coaches Bill Johnson, Homer Rice, Forrest Gregg, Sam Weish, as well as one of the most respected defensive coordinators in the game, Dick LeBeau. How did those men differ in the way they went about their business, and which one of those men had the greatest influence on you and your life?
And, you know, I will also add to that list, when you include Dick LeBeau, is Hank Bulla, who was the defensive coordinator. Mm-hmm. It was he, along with Dick LeBeau, that really started the zone blitz defense. And by virtue of the zone blitz defense, it sort of revolutionized how defensive players can interplay their positions with their teammates to really confuse the offense. And so I would really say that Hank Bulla, who I really didn't get along with, you know, we were always butting heads because he was one of the few coaches that, you know, really it was his way or the highway. He wasn't one of those players, I mean, coaches that would come to his defensive team in the fourth quarter and say, hey, what's working? You know, what do you guys want to do? What are you seeing on the field that I'm not seeing on the sideline? But he was very articulate in designing new ways to attack the offense in the same way that an offensive line attacks the defense.
Now, your post-playing days have been pretty rough physically. You've had over 20 surgeries on your right knee, several infections, and the prospect of losing your left leg to amputation, as well as a tear and a rupture in your aorta, which required open-heart surgery. 6 years ago, you weren't even able to walk. So how are you doing physically right now?
Well, you know, it's amazing that you're sharing that brief medical history. I am doing fabulous today, and it was only just a week ago that I was back on crutches. And, you know, the one thing that once again has allowed me to walk is my flexibility and my balance. And one leg is still 3 inches shorter than the other. And a lot of the complication I'm having now is just checking on the rest of the damage to my body, you know. When I went back on crutches, I realized, you know, my shoulder's kind of sore and I couldn't use the crutches as well as I used to in the past. So one of the things that I really am very grateful for was the opportunity to work at Disney. And during that time, had great medical care. And so even though I've been retired from the Walt Disney Company for 8 years, I was able to maintain a lot of relationships with doctors and medical institutions and have been able to rehab myself on my own. And even today, with so many teammates and other players having so many different medical conditions, I'm just very grateful and continue to pray to God in appreciation for all the blessings in life. Because even as you mentioned, all of our great coaches that I've had a chance to play for, Sam Weish is today waiting for a heart donor because he is very much at risk of heart failure.
They mentioned that actually today on the Jet-Bengal game as well, and you know, everyone wishes Sam the best.
So I'm going to talk a little bit now, Reggie, about Disney and the wider world of sports and how you came to put this whole thing together and your role in this. Now, Mark and I were down there years ago, and we coached a team in a baseball tournament.
Yes.
And I was back there a few times many years after that. When one of my sons was a college cheerleader, he went to the college cheerleading championships there. So what was the vision? How did you develop that whole complex there, which ranges from the Atlanta Braves spring training to the Little League baseball tournaments to the college cheerleading championships?
You know, the real impetus of the quote-unquote big idea was try to see the business from the eyes of the customer that you were trying to attract. And so in this case, I'm trying to see what would be captivating to kids who love sports, kids who love to compete, kids who love to grow in their passion for their sport, and give them a special place that they could go to where no matter whether they won or they lost, their love affair with the sport of their choice would only continue to grow. And that was one of the things that I discovered in Flint, Michigan, because we had one football field called Atwood Stadium in which all of the local high schools could play it. It was like one place where everyone went to sort of prove themselves. And then when you went to Dartmouth College, there was this whole spread of sports fields, baseball, soccer, football, lacrosse, and all of these teams and athletes would come together. And it was all surrounding this sort of town green. And so all of these elements came together in the vision for Disney's Wide World of Sports. And one of the key things that is consistent about Disney's Wide World of Sports is the quality of the surfaces. Whether it's a basketball court, whether it's a baseball field, whether it's a soccer field, whether it was the facilities that were used for gymnastics or for cheerleading, everything had a little bit more substance to it. And even, once again, even if you lost, you had a first-class experience.
Now, on top of working for Disney, you also wore many other hats. You were the vice president slash general manager of the New Jersey Knights in the World League of American Football. As we mentioned, the job with the Disney's Wide World of Sports. You also had an interview for the commissioner of the NFL. How was that interview process for you, and what was it like?
Well, number one, that was one of the real honors of my professional sports career, was to be one of the finalists in consideration for the commissioner of the National Football League. The interviews were coming just at the time where I knew that I was essentially unavailable because I was recovering from a second knee replacement, and that one was not successful. I now had osteomyelitis, and I was about to go into a hospital in New York to really have my third knee replacement and try to save my leg. But my passion for the game is one of the reasons that I still interviewed, and my continued passion for the game is obviously why I continue to follow what's going great in the NFL, and unfortunately, the number of things that aren't going as great as they should be going for the NFL. And one of the things I probably would have done when I, you know, talked about what was driving the vision of Disney's Wide World of Sports is to see sports from the eyes of a child. The one thing that I would sort of say about the NFL in the 10 years that Roger Goodell has been the commissioner is that no one has the impression that the NFL is being seen through the eyes of what is great and good for the NFL player and their fans of the game. And unfortunately, in this climate, when there's a little deviation from that vision, unfortunately, a lot of bad things get magnified.
It's interesting you say that because that opens a door to a totally different conversation. Obviously, if you were the commissioner of the NFL right now, you would be questioned about Colin Kaepernick. And I know that you once said that if you had not used your fame to pursue higher goals, you would have felt that your entire athletic career, which included induction into the College Football Hall of Fame, was a waste. I also know that you're a huge supporter of the First Amendment and the fact that you cannot suppress thought, and you feel that communication and dialogue will help come to share to a shared understanding. With that being said, you know, the arena in which Colin Kaepernick is choosing to protest, and again, a protest is to raise awareness, and you have to do it sometimes in unconventional ways, but what would your take be if you were the commissioner and you had to deal with Colin Kaepernick? What would you say to him?
Well, first, I would say this is one of the things that I'm very proud of Roger Goodell for, because he is recognizing the constitutional rights of the First Amendment and is listening to what is Kaepernick's protest all about. Unfortunately, too many other people are trying to put their own spin on what he is trying to protest, even though he's been very articulate about it. And so they're getting mad about things that have nothing to do with his focus on the inequities of African Americans in America. And I don't think anyone would really have a strong argument to say there have not been a chronic, systematic level of injustices for the African American citizens of the United States of America that are far, far more severe than any other racial group or gender or immigrant group in the history of the United States of America. So the fact that he is trying to call attention to it and calling attention to one of the things that is consistently deemed outrageous, and that's unfortunately the number of young African-American men that have found themselves killed in the hands of law enforcement in various cities across the United States. So it's not like it's one part of the South or just an urban area. It's replete across Americana. And one of the things I think everyone is also recognizing is, even though it was something that Cap did solely on his own, individually, which took tremendous courage, just as I would sort of say the courage, you know, that I had to take in 1987 across the picket line. And the reason I crossed is because I believe that the biggest needs of players at the end of my career was health coverage. It wasn't free agency. But I was, a lone wolf in that aspiration. And even today, you know, 30 years later, that is one of the biggest gripes of all retired players, including, you know, almost 25 years or more retired players, is, hey, what about my health coverage? And what about this now going wrong that I didn't know about when I was playing? So I support what Cap is doing for the reasons he is stating what he is doing, and it is also very much a part of the freedoms that are outlined in the Constitution of the United States, and it's one of the values for which our military and police and firefighters have all committed to their respective professions to ensure the safety of Americans everywhere.
You know, the interesting thing is it's so divisive because of, you know, how people feel about the American flag, and I think that's where the rub comes in, plus the fact now you have social media. You look at the ugliness of the current political campaign, where people who are running for the highest office in the country show no respect for each other, let alone, you know, the populace that has to vote for them. You look at the hatred that gets put out there every day on social media, leveled at Colin as well, and he didn't help himself any by wearing the pig socks either.
Right, that was... in retrospect,
poor
not the
choice.
Best move to
but,
made.
Yeah. You know, the question for me is, if social media was around during the time of the Civil Rights Movement and Dr. Martin Luther King, would social media have made it better or worse for those fighting for civil rights?
That is a great question, you know, because when you think about the four little girls being bombed in a church and on Sunday morning, and how despicable a crime that was perpetuated, you know, by an element, a very, very small element, but an element that had so much hate that they were able to carry this out and go free, you know, for 30, 40 years. Only recently is one of the individuals incarcerated for this heinous crime. And you consider that that's only one of hundreds of events. I mean, crossing the bridge in Selma and the dogs that were unleashed on the protesters then, and the numbers of youth that were arrested and beaten by police in the South in pursuing equal rights. So there's no way that I could believe that social media would not have helped the situation, because it was the general media telling the story of these atrocities that created change. It wasn't the minority of African Americans, or Negroes as we were called it. It wasn't this small minority, less than 20%. That was able to create the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So there were a number of white Americans who also were equally passionate about pursuing equal justice. And that's really what I think Colin is calling for, and what we're not seeing, is we equally have to be passionate about no injustice. Why would someone not want to support that premise? It seems like something that everyone would want to believe in.
You know, another way to ask the question,
we're talking, do you feel...
We're
talking with Reggie Williams, Cincinnati Bengal great.
Do you feel that athletes, because of their fame, because of their just being out there in the public, to some extent have a responsibility to speak up when they see injustices? Or is it something that's such a uniquely personal decision that, you know, is why you see the Colin Kaepernicks and the Muhammad Ali's are so rare?
No, I think it's a uniquely personal decision. I don't think you have an obligation as a professional athlete to speak out on social issues. I mean, you have the First Amendment, the right to remain silent as well. So I do think it creates a unique platform. And that platform is one that is used by other individuals in other forums. There's a number of people in the entertainment industry that have used their platform to espouse some community goodwill. There's been astronauts who have used their platforms. There have been business leaders that have used their platforms. There's been great philanthropists who have used their wealth to change the condition of humanity. So I think while there are great leadership being shown to work on all of the many challenges we have as humankind, I mean, you know, racism is one of the things we should have figured out by now, because we all together have got to deal with all of the climate change that we're way behind the curve. And will be an unfortunate destiny that we're leaving to our kids.
You know, heavy subject matter, and you know, obviously the time of the season as well as we head into election. To shift the focus a little bit back, did you get a chance to watch some football today?
Got a chance to see the Cincinnati Bengals win their first game in New York in 35 years.
That's the game you had to watch. That's the game you had to watch.
Somehow I knew you were watching that game.
Yeah, somehow we knew you were watching that as well. The interesting thing is if you're a Jet fan, it's somewhat same old Jets. Is, you know, they take the lead. That, you know, supposedly they're built on, well, years ago they were built on defense. Not so much now. They're more an offensive team. But you turn the ball over to your defense. You hold them. You get out of that with a win. On top of that, the defense not only doesn't hold them, there's an add-on penalty on the key drive that sets you up for the field goal. You get the field goal. Jets still have 50-some-odd seconds to come downfield. Brandon Marshall, who catches the ball every single time thrown to him,
can't catch
that ball. What was your overall take on the game today?
See, once again, you're seeing the perspective from being a New York Jet, you know, media person. I'm looking at it from the Bengals side of it, and we're looking at someone that walked into a very frenetic home crowd on opening day, unfurling this huge American flag, having Giuliani is their honorary captain, and they played defense and got the Bengals out three and out, and then they stormed down the field and scored, and that was something that the Bengals were now experiencing connected to the very last time they played in that playoff loss to the Pittsburgh Steelers, which was so heart-rending, and this was the start of their day-to-day. So the fact that they won after 25 years and only won by 1 point, and of course I know the 1 point was the same difference as when we won 35 years ago, because I was at that game against Richard Todd, but certainly, it's a big win for any team that wins an opening day. I do obviously always feel bad for hometown crowds, you know. I've spent a lot of time in New York with the New York, New Jersey Knights. You have some great passionate fans for the Jets and the Giants in that community. So, you know, I wish them great luck for the rest of the year. How's that?
Awesome. Okay. Reggie, thanks so much for your time tonight. Where's the best place for people to keep up with everything that Reggie is up to these days?
Well, once again, you know, probably my only social link is to Facebook. And Other than that, it's the opportunities when fine individuals like you on this radio format invite me back to converse. I always appreciate the hospitality and want to, thank all of your fans for all they're doing. And whatever your political aspirations, I just hope everyone will please vote. And, smile. Smile a little bit more. And good luck to everyone.
Reggie, we're giving you an open invitation. Anytime you want to come on, you just shoot me an instant message on Facebook, and we will make the time for you as well.
Enjoy this time, Mark. Enjoy it, AJ.
Same here.
Have a great day.
You too. Okay, thanks so much. Reggie Williams, former Cincinnati Bengal, member of the College Football Hall of Fame.